Hello and welcome to the London Scots podcast, where we talk to Scots who've made it to the big smoke. It's about where they've come from, why they're in London, and what their life is like. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Colin West. Colin, where did you come from and how did you end up in London?
Well, I was born and raised in Glasgow, in the east end of Glasgow, and went to school in Glasgow until fifth year. And after my hires, I went and lived in France for a year as a kind of gap year. I then went to university in England and studied English law. I'm a lawyer, and I did a few years of that. And as you'll know, there's a different legal system in England than in Scotland. So my 4 or 5 years of studying English law didn't entitle me to come back and practice in Scotland. So instead, I decided to put that learning to good use or otherwise down here in London. And I've been practicing as a lawyer ever since. So I qualified probably around about 99. So I've been here, best part of 25 years.
So you left school after fifth year, presumably getting good enough hires to do that. So you didn't want to stay on for 6 years? You were fed up with school, or did the lure of France just take over?
Well, in those days, there was a great enthusiasm for the European Union. It's hard to imagine it now, but people thought that was the future, was to get a European language, and that would open up a lot of opportunities for you. And so I thought that would be probably a better, more useful thing to do than stay on in 6 years. And I'm sure that it was the right decision. It was one of the best things I ever did in terms of, personal independence, learning another language, living in another culture. And it always stood me in good stead in interviews and things like that. People would always ask me about it, even although that was before university, when I was applying for jobs after university. That was always the thing they asked me about. Where were you and what did you get up to in France? And
so where were you and what did you get up to in France?
Well, I had essentially no French whatsoever when I went there. I hadn't done a French higher. So I did 6 weeks of crash course immersion in Paris in a little language school in the Marais, which was wonderful, although I was actually living in a place called Mont-la-Jolie, which is more or less in Normandy. So it was a very long commute. I read an awful lot of novels because I had 3 hours sitting on the train every day. So
French novels? Or
Not at that stage, not at that stage. But after that, I was sent off for the rest of the year to the Loire Valley. So near the city of Tours, if you know that, to begin with, in a little town called Loche, sort of medieval fortress town called Loche. And then after that, in the city of Tours itself, which is, again, a very historic, beautiful, rather bourgeois city in the Loire Valley between Paris and Orléans.
And there had been lots of horrible wine to drink as well, I guess, was there?
There was quite a bit of that. Yeah, I suppose I would have been about 17. We used to do this fantastic thing on a Saturday night of going and having a party in a cave. So these caves near the village, and you couldn't see the party from the outside, but somebody would know where the party was. And down you went into the cave and you have the smell of wood smoke and everyone drinking wine or beer or whatever it was. And that was all rather wonderful.
And were you with an official program, or did you just do this on your tod?
There was an organization, I don't know if they still exist, I think they were called Youth for Understanding, and they had programs in France and the US, I think, as well, and maybe one or two other countries. So they would essentially place you with a family for a period of time, and when that came to an end, they would place you with someone else. So they organized that side of it.
Absolutely fantastic. And so you came back after a year, and you were fluent in French? And
absolutely fluent. The old cliche, I was dreaming in French. When my parents came over to visit, I would say things to them like, sorry, I can't remember the English word for what I was going to say. I mean, I think it would probably be quite different if you went there now, because when I was there, we're now talking, it's the mid-1990s, I mean, literally nobody spoke English in the part of the country where I was. Certainly in the village where I was, the possible exception of the English teacher and a couple of people who might be English enthusiasts. I mean, the main language that they learned in school was German and a bit of Spanish and maybe English down the line. As I say, I suspect you would have a completely different experience now.
And the fact was, there was no, I'm guessing you had no internet or no regular contact.
Nope. Sort of weekly phone call back to my parents, and that was about it.
Wow.
And then writing letters on, I mean, it's amazing to think now, you used to get sort of special tracing paper to write airmail letters on because it was cheaper to send them.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, those days are gone.
They are.
So no wonder people would ask you about that, because obviously for most British people, probably still, speaking a foreign language with any degree of fluency is still seen as being close to Newtonian levels of understanding and ability.
Well, I think that's partly because people mainly try and learn languages through sitting in a classroom and at a school. And I think you're right. I mean, the chances of you achieving or attaining any level of fluency from doing that are absolutely minimal. But having said that, there are now a lot of very good apps on the internet.
Yeah.
Or Duolingo being one good example, which I think, I mean, the resources which are available now are just phenomenal.
They are phenomenal, aren't they? I do remember sitting in my classroom doing Higher French, thinking, what on earth is this for? I mean, really, what practical use is this for? I mean, I know a lot of things at school. You may not find a complete practical use unless you're dissecting frogs or something or other. But really, I mean, I scraped it. I got it on appeal, I think. That was it, my Higher French.
Well, I find it's had a lot of practical uses, apart from the fact that people want to talk about it in interviews. As I say, I'm a lawyer, and I sometimes find myself examining or cross-examining witnesses for whom English isn't their first language. And if you're a monoglot English speaker, I think you can sometimes find it difficult to distinguish between language that someone who isn't a native speaker will understand and language that they simply will not, because it's too complicated. And so a good way of approaching it is, could I say this in French? And if I can't say it in French, don't ask that question, because the witness you're trying to examine probably won't understand what you're saying.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, I'm a huge supporter of languages, and I've gone back and done my Higher Spanish and Higher German as well as an adult.
Oh, well done.
It's fascinating just to get an insight into other cultures and to be able to do something like that, just to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. It's also a very humbling experience, I find, to learn a foreign language.
Well, the one slightly negative aspect of the experience is they all thought I was English. They took a great deal of persuading that I wasn't English, so I would be L'anglais. And I said, I'm not English, I'm Scottish. But they seem to think that being Scottish was a bit like being Breton. So the Bretons are Breton, but they're also French. And they thought, well, the Scots are Scots, but they're also English. And they found it very difficult to understand that that was not, in fact, the case.
Yes. Okay. So you were an ambassador for Scotland in this tiny, tiny wee bourgeois place. Lovely. And then you went back to university. Where did you go to university about?
In Oxford.
All right. And what was that like?
It was fantastic. I had 4 years there. So I did a 3-year undergraduate and a 1-year master's degree. And I mean, I worked quite hard, I must say. I was quite ambitious to get reasonably good grades. I think I may have been a bit chippy or something like that. That may have been the motivation to sort of prove myself. And so I did quite a lot of work. But apart from all that working, I had a very positive experience at university. I did a lot of musical things. I've always been involved in music, so that was the main sort of my main activity outside studying the law.
Did your year in France help getting into Oxford, or had you sewn that up before you left?
The way it worked was, because I hadn't done 6th year, it was a combination. So the entrance was a combination of my higher results, which came out, I think, the summer. When would they have come out? I'm getting the chronology mixed up, but it was a mixture of the higher results and an interview, and I had to come back from France for the interview. I recall doing that, going back to Oxford for the interview partway through the year. But there was no sort of outcome as such. There was no bit of paper at the end of the year in France, apart from having done it. The last year of French school is called Terminale, and it's mainly just a year of exams. The second last year, strangely, is called Première. And there aren't any exams in that. So I was probably old enough to go into the final year, but obviously hadn't done the coursework for the exams. So they put me into Premier, as a result of which I didn't do any exams, which is probably just as well. So I didn't have any sort of exams or baccalaureate at the end of it to show for it.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
And then you came to London after Oxford. And where did you go? Where did you live in London when you came there?
When I first moved to London, we lived in the Docklands. I'd asked various people in Glasgow for advice about where we should live in London, and somebody said, you know, the Docklands is happening at the moment, you should go and live there. I'm not sure how good advice that was. So I mean, again, it goes to show how much the world has changed. You used to get a newspaper, I think it was called Loot, and it'd have a list of flats.
A lot of fun with Loot.
A list of flats that you could go and rent, and you had to physically go there and sort of look around, knock on the door and look around. And then if you liked it, you could say, yeah, well, we're interested in taking this, and you could thrash out a deal. So we lived, I'm not sure it even really counts as the Docklands, but we lived on the Isle of Dogs, right at the bottom of the Isle of Dogs. It's the nearest DLR is Island Gardens, and it was all a wee bit rough and ready down there. When we moved in, one of our neighbours was a man called Ronald Bender. He was about two houses along. We lived in a sort of block. And he was a notorious local, a former gangster, East End gangster.
Love gangster.
If you ever read any books about the Craze, you look up the index and you'll find Ronald Bender was sent to jail with the Craze for the murder, I think it was of Jack the Hat McVitie, the most well-known one that was, I think they got done for eventually and sent down. And he said to me one day, Colin, you know, I was fitted up by the police in that case. They fabricated the evidence against me, the forensic evidence. He said they got me on bloodstains in the car upholstery, which was used to dispose of the body. But Colin, here's the thing. We took that upholstery out of the car and chucked it in the Thames. So anyway, he was more or less harmless, although we had a neighbour who complained about noise at a party that we'd had, and we were telling Ron about this annoying neighbour. He said, Colin, do you want me to go and have a word with him? I said, no, it's all right, Ron, don't go and have a word with him. So we lived there for a bit, and as I say, it was a wee bit.
How did he view you being a lawyer?
I'm not sure I told him, because I was still studying at that time. I wasn't fully qualified when we first moved. So I did a year of law school course, where you convert an academic degree into a more practical qualification. And we used to go across the tunnel. There's a tunnel between that bit of the Isle of Dogs and the other side of the Thames, where you find Greenwich. So me and my flatmate at the time, an old chum of mine called Paul, who's also my best man at my wedding, we used to go through the foot tunnel down to Greenwich, where it was all a bit more salubrious, and go for a few beers in Greenwich. So after a while, I ended up moving over to Greenwich and spent a bit of time there. And then when I got a job as a lawyer and started earning a bit of money, I moved to Clerkenwell, which, as you know, is pretty central, near, I suppose, places like St. Paul's Cathedral, Hatton Garden, and I had a bachelor pad there in Clerkenwell.
And got into that just before the massive price rises of houses in London.
Well, they've always been rising, so it's never been cheap. But whether, as you say, whether someone doing what I did then now could afford to live in those places, I suspect probably not.
And so you moved to Clerkenwell, and then what was life like? So you'd already had quite a lot of experience of different things, but you'd never lived anywhere like London before, I take it.
I hadn't lived anywhere like London before, but as you know yourself from living in London, it's a very different experience living here to what people experience when they visit. So you sort of carve out your own little niche in London, and you can sort of live in a way that you find comfortable and that you like. With, for example, living in Clerkenwell meant I didn't have a long and onerous commute. In fact, I could just walk to my work in 10 minutes. So you would avoid the sort of crush of the tube and the very long commutes and find the local bar that you like and other local activities and parks and so on that you like to visit. It isn't like when people come to London to go to a West End show and they find themselves, you know, not able to get onto the pavement, walking along the Strand or in a big crush in Leicester Square or waiting 25 minutes to get served at a bar with some horrendously overpriced drinks. Yeah, it's a different experience actually living here, and you can put the feelers out and end up living in a way which suits you a bit better.
So you stayed in Clerkenwell, and then did you move from there as your legal career blossomed and you moved out of a bachelor pad?
Yes, well, actually my next move from Clerkenwell was even closer to my work. I was living in a place called Fetter Lane, which is just off Fleet Street. And we actually had our first child there. I met my wife, I think we're still living in Clerkenwell, Antonia, who's now my wife. And we spent a bit of time in the flat on Fleet Street. And I was very happy living in the centre of town and not having to commute. So I could go home and make my own lunch in my own kitchen at lunchtime and so on. But eventually the children arrived and we outgrew the bachelor pad, as one does, and we had to find something a bit more suitable.
What was the change like in your life from being to some extent footloose and fancy free to then becoming a father and married in London and not necessarily having the same freedoms as you had previously? Did London change for you?
I think what I'd have to say about that is my wife's life changed a lot more than mine did. Because I had a job with relatively long hours, which could also be slightly unpredictable. And so I had to be available a lot of the time for work, which meant that in the usual way, I suspect, a lot of the job of looking after the kids and being there for the nurseries and parents' evenings and what happens if the school phones up and says they're not very well, that all really fell to my other half. And so she's had to take the strain, for which I'm eternally grateful, of course. But no doubt she would tell you if you asked her that my life didn't actually change a huge amount. I was still involved in musical things and going to the local pub of an evening. There came a point after, I think it was around about child number three, when I had to scale things back a bit. I was in a choir at the time with a conductor who was known to be quite mercurial. We also had a very few number of rehearsals for any gig that we were doing. The philosophy was the choir moves at the speed of the fastest learner. And if we weren't quite up to scratch with a couple of weeks to go, he would throw in extra rehearsals on a different night. And eventually my wife got a bit fed up with that. I told the conductor at one point that there was a good prospect that I was going to be served with divorce papers and he would be named as the third party. So I had to quit that for a number of years. Although they recently had an anniversary, I think it was the 30th year of the choir existing, and I went back to sing with them again because the youngest child we have is now 8, so things have got a little bit easier.
This is like the 10th time I've done this, so it's going to be the last time, okay? Are you after a great night out in London? Well, if you are, come along to the Cayley Club. We've been doing this since 1998. There's a live band and a caller lets you know the steps. I mean, it's dead easy, but it's really super fun. So if you want to get a bit sweaty and you want to get a gang of people together, a practice before a wedding, an office night out, something like that, or your birthday, great for a birthday party, or indeed, if you just want to come along with your partner or on your tod, doesn't matter. Everybody is welcome. We all have a laugh. It's dead friendly and relaxed in a manic sort of way. It all happens over at CaileyClub.com. You can find all the details there at CaileyClub.com. And that's it. I'm not doing this promo one more time, so it's a wrap. Thanks now, folks. See you at the Cayley Club. Tell us about the musical side to your life then. How did this come about? And how does that manifest itself in your life today?
Well, my grandfather was a railwayman, but he was also a very good musician. He played the clarinet, saxophone, and the flute. He used to play in jazz bands and big bands around about Glasgow. I suppose this would have been the 30s and 40s. And he got me playing the clarinet when I was still in primary school. And that carried on, and that's what I played right up till university and afterwards. I was in the National Youth Orchestra of Scotland for a couple of years, and we did some fantastic stuff. We did the Planet Suite at the Proms in the Albert Hall. We played a Mahler Symphony, I think it was Symphony 4, at the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam. I'm not sure, to be honest, if I was ever quite good enough to be in it, but I somehow managed to get into it. You know, one of those experiences where you realise you've probably risen as far as you're going to rise and perhaps a bit further than you should have risen with the particular skill that you're deploying at the time. That's kind of how I felt in Niles, but it was a fantastic experience.
Did you ever go to, was it Merkerson Castle School over Christmas, over New Year?
No, I did go to Niles a couple of times over Christmas and New Year for winter courses, but it was at a big sort of, I think it was like a seminary in Bear's Den. Fun. Where it used to be held.
Anyway, sorry, I interrupted. It just goes, my parents used to have a bar next door to there, and we used to get some of the National Youth Orchestra of Scotland coming in about that time, just between Christmas and New Year. So anyway, so you were in there, and then you came from this musical family.
Yeah, and then at university, as I was saying, I was mainly playing in orchestras. I did get a chance to play as a soloist in one particular orchestra when there was something happened that they had a change of conductor. The conductor they were supposed to have, it was all students conducting, dropped out, and they got a friend of mine in as the conductor, and they basically said, you know, put whatever program you want together. So he said, well, we'll get Colin to play the clarinet. So I played the Mozart Clarinet Concerto in Christchurch Cathedral. But the interesting thing about it is I was wearing a kilt at the time. So I think it's still the case, as far as I know, that I'm the only person ever to have performed Mozart's Clarinet Concerto with full orchestra whilst wearing a kilt. However, when I got to London, that sort of tapered off. As you probably know, there are lots of clarinet players. In any one orchestra, you will need two, maybe three at a push. There are a few amateur orchestras in London, but what tends to happen with clarinet players is they get in and then they just stay there until they die. So when I came here, occasionally I'd get a berth if somebody was away. I had a berth in something called the London Lawyers Orchestra, playing second clarinet for a couple of years, because their previous second clarinet went off, I think, to do some kind of postgraduate degree. But then he came back, and that was that, and I didn't have anything to play in. So the musical side slightly fell away for a couple of years. But what then happened was, as a lawyer, I have to speak in court a lot, sometimes for quite long periods of time, which is rather unnatural thing to do, in a way, something that most people probably never do, talk for literally hours at a time without stopping. And I kept losing my voice, which, as you can imagine, is not ideal when you're trying to speak in court. And somebody said to me, well, you should take some singing lessons because they'll teach you how to produce your voice in such a way that you can just keep speaking more or less indefinitely without tiring it out. And so I went and did some singing lessons with a singing teacher down in Tooting. And after a while, she said, well, I think I've more or less taught you singing techniques best I can. And so I recommend that to keep it going, because you'll need to keep using the muscles if you want this technique to keep working, you join a choir. And that's the choir I mentioned before, with the very enthusiastic and energetic conductor that I was in for a number of years. And so ever since then, rather than the clarinet, which I occasionally get out, I've mainly been singing.
How long did it take you to, and presumably you did you have a musical, could you sing a little bit? Did you enjoy singing before you took the lessons, or was it something pretty new to
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I mean, I had a band at school and I used to sing in that band, but I never did any organized singing. In fact, my old girlfriend at university, she absolutely hated hearing me sing, I think because she had perfect pitch. And I would sing, and it wouldn't be in exactly the right pitch. It would be a sort of quarter tone above or a quarter tone below. But I always knew I could sing. I used to do a bit of karaoke. And in fact, the night I met my wife, the woman who's now my wife, Antonia, was at a karaoke night. So a karaoke party in a curry house, and sang a couple of songs. So I must have had a reasonable voice, I suppose, since we're still together.
That's lovely. And how long did the singing lessons go on for? I'm saying this because I'd love to sing. I think it's great, and I just don't have confidence. But how long did you take lessons? You're naturally probably more advanced.
A couple of months.
Or would be more advanced. A couple of months.
A couple of months, and then the teacher made what was probably a mistake. She gave me a CD she'd made of vocal exercises and said, so between now and the next lesson, just put the CD on, do the vocal exercises. But I then found, once I had the vocal exercises on a CD, I didn't really need the teacher anymore.
Wow.
Because that's what we would do in the lessons. We'd go and do the vocal exercises and then maybe sing a piece or two. But I could do that on my own. So so that was the end of the singing lessons.
Well, too generous with her help.
I suppose it's a bit like when you go and see a personal trainer and he gives you a list of exercises to do at the gym. And you're like, right, okay. Well, I don't really need the personal trainer anymore.
Tell us about then how that developed. So you were in the choir, and then parental life became a bit much to do that as well. And so then you stepped back from the choir, and what other musical activities did you take on after that?
Well, the musical side took a dip for a while, but something else that I've been involved in, as you know, is the Gaelic language here in London. And so that was...
How did you get involved with that?
Again, it's one of these sort of slightly random turning points. I was at the Edinburgh International Book Festival. My wife was a journalist. And back in the day, before the financial crash, she was a financial journalist mainly. We'd get invites, financial journalists would get invites to quite expensive events to put on or to bring people to, like the Edinburgh Festival. And you could bring a plus one as well. And so we had tickets to the Edinburgh Festival and various things. And we went along to the Book Festival. And as you know, if you've been to the Edinburgh International Book Festival, they have various tents. So you have the German book tent and the French one. And they had the Scottish one. And I was in the Scottish book tent. And there were all these books in Gaelic, or Gaelic, people say it both ways. And I had not a word of Gaelic. And I had one of these moments of cognitive dissonance. I said, wait a minute, I'm the Scottish guy. And being a Scot in London makes you even more conscious of being Scottish. So I probably felt even more Scottish than I would have done if I'd stayed in Scotland. Here I am in the Scottish book tent, and there's shelves and shelves of books I can't understand. This doesn't seem right somehow. So when I was in the tent, I bought a couple of starter books on the Gaelic language. And that was in about 2007. And off I went on that. So started with the books and then a TV programme, Speaking Our Language, which is still repeated on BBC Alapa from time to time. A wonderful old TV programme on learning the Gaelic language. And then after I'd done that, I started going up in the summer for a week at a time to Solmoor Ostach, which is the Gaelic language college on the Isle of Skye, in Slate on the Isle of Skye, and to do week-long courses. I think started at level 1 or 2, and it goes up to about 12, and I think over the years I got up to about 8 or 9. And when I was on one of those courses, there was a girl in my class who also lived in London, and I said, why don't you come to the London Gaelic classes, which I knew nothing about. So I looked into that and started doing that. That's on Wednesday evenings. There are currently two classes, two different levels of class. No, actually, currently there are three levels. It varies depending on numbers whether they have two or three classes. And so I've been doing that ever since. They're now on Zoom ever since the pandemic, but they're formerly in person, and presumably at some point we'll go back to being in person or in hybrid. And that got me into the sort of London Gaelic scene, which is the classes. There's also the Gaelic Society, which puts on sort of cultural events relating to the Highlands and the language, and the London Gaelic Choir as well. And the London Gaelic Choir, again, the numbers have fluctuated over the years, and over some periods of time it's been sort of half dormant, but they've had a flourishing of numbers in the last couple of years. And in 2019, they went up to the Mod, which was in Glasgow that year, after a gap of certainly perhaps 10 or 20 years since the London Gaelic Choir had last been at the Mod. So I thought, well, how can I not sing at the Mod in the London Gaelic Choir, given that it's in Glasgow? So I've been singing as well with the London Gaelic Choir from time to time, on top of my various other things that I do.
Excellent. So talking about the various other things you do, you've got quite a full life as it is, and particularly with the three young kids, you'll be busy. But what else do you get up to, or do you get up to anything else in London?
Yeah, I mean, I now live in southeast London, near Dulwich, which a lot of people who are not from London don't know because it isn't on the tube. But it's a part of southeast London which is pretty green, quite sort of family orientated. And we get up to lots of stuff around there. With having kids at the local schools, you get to know the other parents whose kids are the same age as yours. And there are lots of social activities connected with that. There's a local pub called The Half Moon that I'm quite fond of going into. Me and the dog, occasionally if I'm out walking the dog, might find ourselves in there for a quiet pint or two. Another sort of Scottish activity, I suppose, which I get involved in from time to time in London is the Rangers Supporters Club. I'm a Rangers man myself. My old man's a season ticket holder. He was amazed, actually, when he came down to London once and there was a game on. It must have been a midweek game. I said, "Ugh, we'll go up to the Rangers Club and watch the game." And we went up, and everyone else in the pub was basically a Glaswegian. And it was like his place. He goes to a bar called the Log Cabin in Baileyson if he's not at the game himself. And it was like sitting in the Log Cabin. Everybody around just talking in these broad Glasgow accents. And there we are, in the middle of London. He found it most strange. So, yeah, occasionally do that. We haven't had much to cheer about recently, but that's football.
Very good. Okay, Colin, we come to that time in the show where it's joke or app time. So you either have to tell us a good joke or tell us about an app that you use that is indispensable.
Gosh. Well, not very good at jokes. So an app that I use which is indispensable is a language learning app called Anki, A-N-K-I.
Oh, never heard of this one. A-N-K-I, Anki.
It is fantastic. It's essentially, it's flashcards. And you can make your own flashcards, and you can add sound files to the flashcards.
Okay.
So there's, on the internet, there's a speaking Gaelic dictionary. It's called the Learn Gaelic Dictionary. And when you look up a word, there's a sound file. So if I ever come across, or whenever I come across a word in the Gaelic, and I think, I've got to remember that word, I'll record on one side of the Anki flashcard the Gaelic spelling, and whether it's masculine or feminine, so on and so forth. Then the English on the other side, and then I can also record the sound of the Gaelic word. And when you click on the app, not only does the word flash up, it will say it.
Ah, perfect.
It is absolutely wonderful.
That's really great. Because I've learned German in many different ways, in many different formats, but not quite with that, with the flashcards and the sound together.
Yeah, it's very good.
Particularly for the words that you want to make yourself, those words in particular.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, that's great. Well, Colin, thank you very much for your time this morning and for sharing your views. And if people want to join the London Gaelic Choir, they just Google that, of course, don't they? And all the details will pop up.
They do. I actually made a website myself called Gaelic in London, which is still there. I made that a few years ago, which has information on all the different Gaelic activities which are going on in London. The reason I made it is that at that time, none of the other Gaelic groups had their own website, or their websites were not very good. It's become slightly less necessary recently because the other groups, or at least the London Gaelic Society and London Gaelic Choir, they have their own websites now. But if you want it all in one place, you can just go to gaelicinlondon.net and you'll find all the information there.
Brilliant. Good. Well, thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
And have a lovely day. Oh, and Colin, anytime you want to come down to the Cayley Club, you've got two free tickets as a thank you for appearing on the London Scots podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dar. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the London Scots podcast. The wonderful music was provided by License to Cayley, And if you're looking for a great night out in London, then head over to the Cayley Club for 3 hours of dancing to a live band and caller. No experience necessary. Thanks again, and lang may your limerick.